A new documentary on the late civil rights icon Ann Braden is coming out. The Louisville social justice advocate gained notoriety as an affluent Southern white woman who led many campaigns against Jim Crow laws at the height of segregation. I'm Philip Bailey, and this is Noise and Notes. I talked with Braden biographer Kate Fossil, who is the director of the Ann Braden Institute at the University of Louisville. We talked about Braden's legacy, the new documentary, and if her brand of social justice still matters in a so-called post-racial America.
Racism is alive and well, as the Obama presidency has demonstrated. White privilege is alive and well, as, you know, anybody that studies seriously the census data, all the literature that suggests that, you know, there are racial disproportionalities that really can't just be reduced to economics. And I think still in all, there are, especially perhaps after the heyday of the civil rights movement, where we have legal, we don't have legal segregation anymore. We have equal rights laws. But I think there are many white people in particular, many people generally, that remain, you know, blind to the reality of white privilege. And so Ann Braden's life is a message to us that is of vital importance.
Well, there's a new documentary about Braden, produced by filmmakers Ann Lewis and Mimi Pickering from Apple Shop, which is a nonprofit media center out in eastern Kentucky. Yes. It's called Ann Braden, Southern Patriot, which is, I believe, named after the newsletter that she once ran. And it premieres this Sunday at the Kentucky Center for African American Heritage. Why a new documentary now, particularly 6 years after her death? I know you were a part of that. Many different people will be a part of that documentary. Mm-hmm. I think everyone's really eager to see it. Why this new documentary now?
Well, I mean, I think it's still a timely moment, as I mentioned, but it's also the case that the documentary's been in progress since before her death. In fact, the filmmakers, and I was the humanities advisor on that film, had to sort of take a little different tack because she did die unexpectedly. And it was that kind of, cinema verite approach where they were sort of following her around with the camera. So then when she died, they had to make
that change the direction of the film.
Yes.
Because Ann Braden died at 2006, 81 years old, sort of unexpected. Another blow to the civil rights movement here, sort of similar to what happened with Reverend Lewis Coleman when he died. But Braden wasn't without her own controversies. But you're considered the definitive biographer of Ann Braden. Your book, Subversive Southerner, it came out in 2006. What do you think about the documentary? Have you seen it, or what are your thoughts on it?
I have seen it, and I think it follows much of the same path, frankly, that my book follows, but with a lot more attention to sort of the later years after the 1968 and the heyday of the civil rights movement ended, which, of course, Ann Braden continued the quest and her untiring work for racial justice right up until her death in 2006. So you really learn a lot of stuff that historians have frankly not yet chronicled for the most part about a lot of the struggles for racial, economic, social, environmental, gender justice of the 1980s and 90s in the movie.
When you think about, because, you know, when I think about Ann Braden, I knew her for a short period of time at the end of her life when I was at U of L. Met her and talked to her a few times. I remember she lectured a class out there. When you think about Southern white women in the midst of the civil rights movement, to be honest, today the pop culture reference is The Help, that movie based on the book by Catherine Stockett. Literally, ladies of leisure and their relationship to their black servants. But Braden's legacy is the exact opposite of that, right?
I mean,
she's someone who was a pretty affluent Southern white woman, grew up in Alabama, but who did everything in her power to throw away that privilege and to sort of dive right into this, at the time, a controversial movement. I mean, people think of it now, we're in 2012, they think, oh, you know, racial equality, whether you think that race is still an issue in this country or you think that we're a post-racial country, or do you think that, you know, people are playing the race card and using that to get advantages in society. There was a point in American history where there was pretty much a police state, and domestic terrorism was the remedy for anyone who got out of line, black or white, to break that segregationist history or segregationist practice. Is that really Braden's legacy, that she's someone who went against her own privilege and tried to give it up as much as possible?
Yes, she did, although she used that privilege as well. I guess I would say, let's be clear, that white Southern womanhood was the kind of crown jewel of white supremacy. White Southern womanhood was the basis of the argument in many ways for first slavery and later segregation and racial hierarchy. So indeed, some of the images you see in The Help, though it's very airbrushed, are true. I think there was a lot of that. And what you also said is also the case, that Anne went against that. She went against the grain in a big way at a time when, yes, that was a phrase she was fond of using. There, it was a police state, especially in the plantation South, the former Confederate South, and border states like Kentucky, where segregation was legal, that it was really risky for whites to step out of the magic circle and to ally themselves with African Americans, who themselves faced a lot of risks and violence to act against white supremacy.
I was going to say, because you talked about how that was the crown jewel, but how did other Southerners view Braden? Because when I met her, I mean, she was someone who consistently, even when African Americans would sort of take a more conservative or mild approach, she would push the conversation further, even at the end of her life. How was she viewed? Was she viewed mostly as a turncoat? For giving away or trying to use her racial privilege for others? Or was she embraced later on? She clearly wasn't embraced in the time and the peak of her her activism.
Well, a common phrase was race traitor. She was known as a race traitor. She was known as a Red. She was charged with sedition here in Louisville in 1954. Her, picture was posted all over the Southern press in those years as someone to stay away from. Yes, she was quite the pariah, actually, especially in Louisville here for really decades. But by the time you met her, she's this like sweet little old lady.
Sweet little old lady, yeah.
Exactly. And civil rights had become, at least in its legal sense, a reality.
That both sides now sort of say, we agreed, we just had a little few mild differences, but for the most part, it was just a phase in American history. That's how it's sort of viewed as now.
Well, in my book, I have a phrase, from pariah to heroine, that sort of just, you know, summarizes that like odyssey that she went through from the difference between the 1950s, 60s, and 70s till like the turn of the century. And she always said, you know, you got that right, because they used to give me brickbats, now they give me awards.
Was that unsettling for her? I mean,
it was.
Or in some sense, a sense of accomplishment. I mean, because Braden did face two twin movements, the backlash against the civil rights movement, which often was a partner with the height of McCarthyism. The idea that if you're white and you want to help African Americans in the midst of this segregationist system, either you're insane or you're a communist working with some sort of Soviet spy or Soviet group to undermine and overthrow the United States.
Yes, it didn't leave a lot of room in the middle, though there was a sizable group, especially here in Louisville, one might argue, of white moderates, white liberals, who were much more a fan of sort of gradualist change, okay?
Well, those of us who study history who know Anne Braden, she's most famous for her and her husband, Carl Braden, bought the house for this African-American family, the Wades, in Shively, which at the time was a suburb of Louisville. Many people live in Shively now. I mean, I know that history, but they bought a house for the Wades. And eventually, when people found out that a black family moved in, well,
there was
dynamite,
a cross burning, shots through the windows,
bombing.
And 6 weeks later, dynamiting, destroying
domestic terrorism.
The house. Yes, domestic terrorism.
And that's how she sort of became famous. But she was certainly affiliated with other movements. I think of William McGee in Mississippi.
Yes.
That situation where the man who was accused of rape, who many felt was innocent. I think even NPR did a story about 2-3 years ago on the McGee history. They got all the way up to Harry Truman with people trying to petition for him to be pardoned. There are other movements that she was associated with. Her post-civil rights career, though, what was her focus? Clearly, as a civil rights act, Voting Rights Act was passed in the 1960s. You know, certainly there was the Black Power movement after that, but where does she go sort of after the legal barriers were torn down?
Well, one thing that's important to know is you mentioned, and I mentioned, the pariah that she was, the radical that she was. Well, part of what differentiated her from a liberal view all along was the fact that she saw the struggle against racism as one central part of a wider struggle for economic justice, for a labor movement, for full employment, for a more peaceful foreign policy. And in fact, it was that kind of connection of racism with war and poverty that the Cold War and the anti-communist witch hunt had done so much to destroy a widespread understanding of those links. So it was continuing those kinds of linkages. And her passion was always racial justice. Let's be clear, that's what she pursued pretty much single-mindedly, but she pursued it within all those other movements by reminding the participants that racism was in that movement too, was implicated somehow.
You mentioned President Obama earlier. What do you think that Anne Braid would have thought about President Barack Obama?
Well, you know, you could see that he was on the ascendance even before she died, after he'd made that powerhouse speech.
But certainly people didn't think he was going to be president.
No, but there'd been talk about it. I once tried to ask her about it, honestly, in the last couple years of her life, and she really didn't want to engage that, because at that point, she really wasn't dealing with national politics at all. She had become very, very local, and that was her focus, and that was her
passion. Which is really interesting, because she was someone who knew... Mm-hmm. You know, had someone like Cornel West
right.
on speed dial.
Right.
I mean, she was
right.
someone who could just, you know, she had her fingertips, literally all these nationally, mm-hmm. internationally known mm-hmm. people. But she was someone who was very much focused on here. I'm here.
Exactly.
Politics is local. I'm here in Louisville, not somewhere else.
Because ultimately she was a grassroots person. She was not destined for, nor did she want that kind of, you know, wider leadership role. She wanted to see change in her midst. And that's what she struggled for here in Louisville.
But isn't the rise of President Obama evidence that Braden's viewpoint won out and that revisiting the past is not the road to success? The idea that we should continually go back to the origins of slavery and what was done to Native Americans, that's over. The whole point of this country, the whole point of the American experiment is that we move on, we can cleanse ourselves of that. I mean, Obama's presidency and candidacy is based largely not upon going like Al Sharpton's, you know, presidential candidacy or Jesse Jackson's, not this redemption or even atonement, but moving forward from that as one country.
Well, she would definitely fuss with you about that. No, she had a real passion for history. And though she wasn't, you know, trained as a historian, she actually had a very, very sophisticated understanding of history and a passionate, you know, ability to argue history. So, in fact, she would speak against, you know, the idea that we can ever forget the past.
So she would have been someone who would totally rejected the idea of Obama representing a post-racial America.
Yes, she would reject that idea, though I think she would see the fact that he could get elected as a victory. And I think that we, you know, you and I probably would agree with that. But it's a limited victory. It's a victory in which we have to continue to hold people's feet to the fire.
But didn't Obama, I mean, his personal biography, the books that I've read about him from, and not so the outside, I mean, people who've gotten in with people who are close to him, the personal biography of Obama and his candidacy itself was one that did everything it could to avoid talking about race until mm-hmm. it was brought to his doorstep with the Reverend Wright controversy. Isn't that a testament that going back and continually being anchored by race isn't the road to sort of that achievement, which for many middle-class African-Americans, Obama is sort of the epitome of that achievement that has always been sought? I'm being judged by my character, not by my race.
Well, I think, again, not to get too much into psychologizing Obama, but he seems to want to have it both ways. He's never disassociated himself from his blackness, but he did certainly de-emphasize that in the campaign, and there have only been a very few moments when he emphasized it. So I think that while he, in his private moments, would not really, you know, suggest that we're in a post-racial era, his presidency has unfolded accordingly. But what you're talking about, I think, has much more to do with his personal biography and his own outlook and experiences couched within an administration. I mean, he's not the king, okay? He's got, and I don't mean Dr. King, I mean like the, you know, your majesty. He's got a team that he works within. And so I think the jury is still out on Obama's legacy, though the points you've raised, I would certainly not disagree.
And the fact that despite his election and the cultural achievement that represents for many, there has been a backlash even to his election. I mean, the birther movement.
Absolutely.
I mean, the idea that from some that he is not even an American, that he is some foreign agent, which sort of interestingly ties all the way back to the idea of Anne Braden, that she was some sort of actor for
a foreign
conspiracy. Mm-hmm. The idea that, where's your birth certificate? In fact, show me your birth certificate, as if you sort of have to prove. I've never seen George W. Bush's birth certificate or Theodore Roosevelt's or Abraham Lincoln's, but show me your birth certificate. Prove it to me.
Yes. So I think that, you know, it was a symbolic victory. It was an important victory, but we cannot look to the victory, you know, the election of Barack Obama once or even twice as some definitive ruling on race. No, I think we are not in a post-racial society, and she would be the first to argue that.
On this program before, I had a panel of folks talking about the legacy of Reverend Lewis Coleman, and I talked about today's civil rights leaders. Mm-hmm. There was a long pause, a awkward long pause. Who's taking up Braden's mantle? When I think nationally, I think of Tim Wise. But locally, I think maybe of a Carla Wallace. But
Carla Wallace, yes.
I don't really think of anyone of a certain demographic, of a certain age group, of a certain generation who's taking up that mantle.
Well, I think what you have here in Louisville
is maybe that the idea of younger whites is sort of passé to them, the idea of race being a difference.
I think there's quite a cross-section here in Louisville whenever there's a march, whenever there's an issue that comes out. I do think that there is a lot of cross-racial movement building, organizing, marching, more than in a lot of comparable size cities. And I would attribute Anne's legacy to that in part. I mean, too often you've had like the white peace movement, the people of color justice movement. It doesn't break down that neatly in Louisville. You can't point so much to a figurehead. I mean, you mentioned Carla, and that's certainly, you know, someone who comes close. But I think it's a more diffuse legacy than just in the, you know, in one person taking that role.
Well, Professor Kate Fossil, thank you very much for joining me for this discussion.
Well, you're quite welcome. Thank you for having me, and I hope everybody will come out to the film premiere at 3 p.m. on Sunday.
Recently, a group of Louisville hip-hop artists and others came together for an activism workshop, and many believe hip-hop politics is making a comeback. But what exactly does a youth genre, more associated with spruced-up cars, flashy jewelry, and booty music, have to do with politics? I talk with hip-hop duo Cypher Divine and Leo Weekly critic Damian McPherson about the ongoing debate over the genre's message.
Hip-hop, since its inception, has been one of the most externally and internally scrutinized forms of culture that we've ever seen. That, you know, from the very beginning, there was, you know, that other guy in the corner saying, well, you shouldn't be talking about that. We should be talking about this. Or even as simple as, well, you whack, I'm better, give me the mic. To the idea that as soon as people started selling records, you know, in you know, Reagan's 80s of this amazing microscope that was put on the entire culture. You know, and here we are another election season, and this argument, this debate comes up every single election season because it's such easy fodder.
Because I don't hear, for example, any rap artist talking about voter suppression laws, which would target minority youth in particular this election cycle. I haven't heard any of that in any records. And maybe this not necessarily has to be in the music itself. Maybe, is it the idea of hip-hop politics, is it maybe just the wrong branding of it? For example, if someone listens to country western music and they vote Republican, or they're involved in the Tea Party and they're very conservative, they don't call it country western activism or country western politics.
Right.
It's Tea Party politics.
Right.
Is it really hip-hop politics, or is it people who are involved in social justice who just happen to listen to rap?
Well, and that's the thing. Hip-hop gets used as a euphemism, just like the word urban gets used as a euphemism. I mean, let's kind of cut through the cloud a little bit and speak on it for what it's really supposed to be. You know, that especially a lot of the criticism that goes in for, you know, hip-hop culture is not, you know, a critique of anything to do with an 808 drum machine, has nothing to do with anybody with a microphone. It's, well, I'm uncomfortable with this group of people over here. And that's the idea. But the euphemism is it's hip-hop.
Yeah.
It's a great boogeyman.
Yeah, it's youth culture in general. I mean, even before hip hop, even during the reign of hip hop, during with the '80s bands, the big hair bands, there was, You know, there was outcry against that. You know what I mean? You know, the rebellious youth, they were listening to rock and roll. You know, and then there, at one point, there was outcry against the darker side of rock and roll with the Marilyn Mansons. And are kids committing suicide because of rock and roll? Is it having this negative, dark effect on them? You know, so it's not just hip-hop. Hip-hop just happens to be the prevalent form today. You know, I mean, it happens to be the most popular form of music right now. It's the new rock and roll. Yeah. And so when you say hip-hop culture, is it really just hip-hop culture? Is it popular culture that we're actually referring to? Yeah. You know what I mean? A lot of people just automatically think hip-hop culture, think baggy jeans and 808 drum machines. But you're looking at a wide spectrum there when you say hip-hop culture.
And one of the more interesting things now, I mean, you know, 25, 30 years in, is that we're looking, you know, sales are down everywhere. Not just hip-hop, but especially hip-hop. Sales are way down. But the overall impact of the culture is larger than it's ever been. But, you know, bringing up rock and roll, bringing up heavy metal and the hair bands and stuff like that, it seems like every generation has that great piece of culture for the generation before it to be afraid of.
Exactly.
Well, at this point, you know, there is, I mean, what is the next thing? What is the next thing that's going to scare mom and dad? You know, hip hop at this point, like
skinny jeans and mohawks.
Well, I mean, Skrillex scares the hell out of me personally, but
no, really, the idea I've noticed that people from a certain generation of hip hop, they have a problem with kids, especially men, boys, wearing skinny jeans and having mohawks.
But I mean,
I remember it's been around.
Yeah, I remember the 80s too. Like I remember skinny jeans and Pumas and all that. And it's like, well, now I just look at it like, oh yeah, been there, done that. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I'm just waiting for, you know, the generational shift to turn yet again. I mean, leggings and just all that kind of fashion side of things, like it's all back, it's all cyclical, you know. My wonder with it though, as far as, you know, on the selling side of it, you know, I mean, part of my background goes into the how can I sell this side is, you know, really what is the next thing? You know, that at this point, hip-hop, mom and dad saw LL Cool J at the Fresh Fest. Mm-hmm. Like, mom and dad saw, like, so there's no, you know, other side to that coin. Like, what's the next thing? Like, you know, for the brief second, there was Marilyn Manson and that thing. Like, but so much of the passion that goes into kind of culture wars, because that's kind of what this is. And, you know, the cyclical election thing. Goes in the culture. Well, what is left to shock people?
Well, we'll find out. Damien, Wise, Sultra, thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Noise and Notes on WFPL is produced by me, Philip Bailey, with Joe Durso. For more, visit WFPL.org.